It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in a few moments, we'll talk about the best horror movies from the last 30 years or so in honor of Halloween.
First, we're talking about the election next week. All year long, Governor Scott Walker and Democratic challenger Mary Burke have said the outcome of their election will come down to voter turnout. And in a midterm election in a divided state like Wisconsin, there are reasons to believe they might be right. Sean Johnson reports.
When President Barack Obama makes a rare midterm campaign stop at North Division High School in Milwaukee.
Give it up for your next governor, Mary Burke!
Or when Governor Scott Walker makes stop after stop at factories in Eau Claire.
It's one of the best things about being governor, is getting out of the Capitol and touring this state. It's why I'm up here in the Chippewa Valley so much.
Of course they're there to talk about why their ideas are good and why the other side's ideas are bad. But especially at this late stage in a campaign, they're mostly thinking about turnout, how to get people who support them to actually follow through and vote. That question has been most perplexing to Wisconsin Democrats, who won the last 7 presidential elections, but just 2 of 7 midterm gubernatorial races. Sean Paff was the deputy campaign manager for Jim Doyle in 2006, the last time Democrats won the governorship. He's now a lobbyist and the mayor of Fitchburg. Paff says what it boils down to is people who normally vote in presidential races stay home during the midterms.
Those folks that are less inclined to turn out tend to be single people, especially women, voters under the age of 35, minorities, and those tend to be Democratic base voters.
In the last 2 midterms, 2.1 million people voted. The state's election agency thinks turnout this year will be closer to the recall, when 2.5 million people voted. Governor Walker has won in both scenarios, but even Republicans concede that the recall was a different race. Lobbyist Brandon Scholes has been involved in GOP politics since 1974.
I think you have to discount some of the voters in 2012 in the recall because, and I think most people will agree and tell you, that there were folks who didn't necessarily support Scott Walker, but voted for him in the recall because they disliked the recall process.
Recall or not, Scholes says Walker can win a higher turnout race using the traditional Republican model. Huge turnout in Waukesha, Washington, and Ozaukee counties, and solid numbers in counties north of there up to the Fox Valley. Paff says Democrats need to win big in Milwaukee County and the Madison media market, then win a bunch of western Wisconsin, too.
It's important that they get to key targeted areas, and I think you'll see Mary Burke work those areas of the major media markets, trying to convince her voters. She maybe will stop on some college campuses to get them excited as well.
But perhaps nowhere is there a better chance for Democrats to gain votes than in Milwaukee. Scholes says that's why you saw President Obama there this week.
If they were assured that they had their numbers in Milwaukee, you probably didn't need to bring in a high-risk visit by the president. And considering the places that he's not going, all of a sudden he shows up in Wisconsin. I think that turns some heads. But, you know, you have to, when you run a campaign, you have to make that call. You have to say, look, I need a bigger contribution to our base turnout. Well, what can get me that?
The president's visit came after the last Marquette poll, which showed Walker up 7 over Burke among likely voters, but up just 1 among registered voters. If the likely voters' number is right, Walker coasts. But if Burke can persuade those registered voters to actually vote, it could be a long night next Tuesday. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Well, trick-or-treating is starting now, and we're going to help get in the mood for Halloween with a film critic talking about great horror movies.
With some frightening things happening in the headlines lately, the Ebola outbreak, there's war, school shootings, do we still need horror movies? Well, our next guest says we need the genre now more than ever, and he's here to make that case. He also shares his favorite horror movie since The Shining came out in 1980.
David Edelstein is chief film critic for New York Magazine and NPR's Fresh Air. David, welcome to Central Time and happy Halloween.
Well, thank you very much. It's already begun here with a vengeance. So
and
I
understand you are actually serving out some trick-or-treat candy as we speak.
You know, I'm sitting here on my stoop. I have my zombie research facility sign. I've got a skeleton hanging. I've got a big bowl of candy. This is Brooklyn, so it's fairly ethically traded candy. I've got my cocktail. I'm all ready for the evening. Yes.
Well, that's wonderful. And you're not showing horrifying movies to the children as they approach, though, I hope.
No. Yeah, it's funny. The children that I've seen so far are in Spider-Man costumes and butterfly costumes and fairy costumes. It's more along the superhero lines. I mean, it's almost as if the traditional horror figures, or maybe it has something to do with the national mood that they're receding. Of course, I live in a more residential neighborhood over in Park Slope, which is the hipster part of Brooklyn. It's a little more outré, I guess you'd say. I mean, there were kids wearing Gian Gomeshi masks. It was terrifying. I mean, it's... Oh. God, keep your distance.
All right, we won't go dig too deep into that one. Well, speaking of the national mood, though, there's a lot of things in the news, scary stuff, Ebola, ISIS, you name it. You wrote a piece lately on why it's important to have horror movies when we've got so much real-life horror. So what's the deal?
Well, you can't, you have no room to sort of repress these things. You know, you need some outlet for getting through them. And even though I've come to believe less and less in the kind of quasi-Freudian concept of catharsis, I still think we need to do something to confront these things. We need to look at the worst-case scenarios. Okay, what's the worst-case scenario of Ebola? Then plague-ridden cannibalistic zombies, right? What's the worst case of this whole Gamergate thing, this crazy abuse of women that's going on the internet, then, you know, looking at the roots of some of these stalker movies and what they say about the culture now. You can go through the list of kind of what the national traumas are. You know, surveillance, constant surveillance. You have the Saw movies in which this guy is basically monitoring people the whole time and torturing them, you know, in a manner that the NSA can only envy, the CIA can only envy. Oh, we got somebody here. Hello. Hi. Take two or three. Yeah, take three. I'm on the radio.
So real-time trick-or-treating going on there with David Edelstein, film critic.
Bye.
All right, what were the costumes?
Adorable.
What were the costumes, David?
Well, she was actually, it was a girl, and she was wearing a Batman costume, but it looked like red silk pajamas with a Batman logo on it.
Huh.
So it's a very interesting, we're seeing lots of variations on the theme.
Well, let's get into some of your favorite horror movies, and you mark horror movies, modern horror movies, from The Shining.
Why is that a turning point? No, let me correct you there. We did a list at Vulture of the most interesting horror movies since The Shining, just because we thought they were a little more current. But, you know, the beginning, really, of the modern horror film, I would say, was George Romero's Night of the Living Dead. I mean, it was Romero, zombies, you know, really, his zombies really aren't the classic zombies. Those are sort of undead slaves who were employed by, you know, crazed capitalists in Haiti, whereas it was Romero who introduced the zombie cannibal plague idea. And what was great about that was he did it at the sort of the height of the counterculture of a lot of really horrible things going on with the civil rights, with you know, blacks being beaten by, you know, by white sheriffs, and he incorporated that into the movie, and it really captures, as very few movies made in 1968 do, the disintegration of the nuclear family, the collapse of the social order. I mean, it is the perfect example of how horror can create this metaphor that is more penetrating, that is more far-reaching than a standard conventional movie like In the Heat of the Night that explores some of the same issues. It's just more powerful. Now, it's cruder, it's crasser, it's more sensationalistic. I'm not going to tell you that, you know, every horror film is you know, some great work of cinematic art, but there's a lot more in the genre than the popular audience often gives it credit for.
You know, does a horror movie have to have that metaphor, that resonance with the real world, or can it just scare us and still be a good movie?
Well, it can be a good movie, but if you can sit there and have jolts, but the scariest movie I've seen in the last few years that was just a sort of haunted house exorcism movie was The Conjuring. And The Conjuring has a huge political, you know, kind of reactionary subtext. It's about a family collapsing and a weak mother who can't keep control of her kids. And as a result, a demon moves in and gets her because she's the weakest link, and the demon tries to kill her children. And that really does tap into this feeling of, you know, mothers being sort of torn between working and staying home and projecting all this stuff on their kids. And, you know, most mothers can manage that, can deal with the resentment they inevitably feel toward their kids in this age when women are expected to do a little something more. But that movie was an example, again, of a sort of a worst-case scenario. You know, the devil comes in, she tries to kill her kids, the Catholic Church has to come in and exorcise the demon. And it's another great advertisement for the Catholic Church, which The Exorcist was too. So it's a very conservative movie. Most horror films you'll find do have political subtexts. I mean, you have to look at it, and I know there are lots of people out there listening going, oh, it's just a movie, it's entertaining, it's supposed to scare us. Well, sure, but there are lots of other things going on in the great horror movies than just trying to give you a scare.
We're talking to film critic and tonight candy distributor David Edelstein about the best horror movies and why we need horror now maybe more than ever.
We're taking your calls on this too. What is your favorite horror movie of all time and why? Do you think we still need scary horror movies and why do you think we seek them out even when things are kind of plenty scary in the real world? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're picking up our conversation now with film critic David Edelstein about the best horror movies since The Shining.
You can join in with your favorites at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Let's give a listen to a quick clip of The Shining.
Wendy.
Sally!
Darling, light of my life. I'm not going to hurt you. You didn't let me finish my sentence. I said, I'm not going to hurt you. I'm just going to bash your brains in.
Let's go to a caller before we throw that to David Edelstein. We've got Molly with us in Eau Claire. Molly, hi.
Hey, oh, that's funny. That's the clip you just played because that's why I was calling The Shining. I saw it when my brother was babysitting me when I was in fourth grade.
Uh-oh.
And that freaked me out, and that line, too. I mean, the red rump, everything. And I still, to this day, see Jack Nicholson, like, a, you know, the Academy Awards or whatever, and I'm terrified of him.
Molly, thanks for the call. David, a lot of people cite The Shining as one of their favorite horror movies. I understand that wasn't the case when it came out, though.
No, it actually didn't do that well. I mean, I think a lot of people found it kind of tame, which is weird because Kubrick said publicly he really wanted to hurt people with that movie. I think it's lasted so well. Again, I know there are a lot of people out there who are going, ah, this pointy head, you know, talking about themes and messages. But very few films have ever captured, first of all, the kind of rage of a patriarch at his family, you know, sort of inhibiting him creatively. Few films have ever caught that feeling of a writer whose brain is kind of grinding emptiness, but is a creative person, any creative person, but who is trying to sort of put on a show for the world that he's actually doing something. Few films have ever caught what it's like to be alone in some place for a long time with, you know, your child and your wife. I'm not talking about my own marriage here, but you know, these things are all in the movie. They're all the things that sort of Stephen King was writing about, in addition to the child who has second sight and who sees the worst case scenario in his parents fighting. It's a very, very rich film. I don't think it's a perfect film, but it's a very rich film, and it's no mystery why it sort of captured the public imagination.
Molly, thanks for the call. Hope you've recovered from seeing that in the fourth grade. We'll go to Keith with us now in Green Bay. Keith, hi.
Hi. I think that Alien, the first one with Sigourney Weaver, is probably one of the scariest movies I've ever seen. And it crosses two genres. It's the classic stuck in the haunted house movie, but it's set in outer space.
Keith, thanks so much for that. David, I've always said Alien was a horror movie, not a science fiction movie.
Oh, it is a horror movie, but I love what he said because it's the space, you know, that amazing advertising line, in space no one can hear you scream. That intensifies the isolation of the, oh, we got a trick-or-treater here. I'm going to hold on to Alien. Hi, how are you? Take two, three,
that's David
four.
Edelstein. He's giving out Halloween candy as we talk about scary Halloween movies. You can share your favorites at the Central Time Facebook page. What is your favorite scary movie of all time?
Let's talk about Alien for just a second, because Alien is a touchstone in what some people call this sort of body horror subgenre. I mean, what's really terrifying about Alien is that it's full, the design of H.R. Giger and the set design is all full of, you know, weird kind of phallic or even, pardon my language, sort of vaginal imagery, and the alien actually impregnates this guy and then erupts out of the stomach, and I know that's a spoiler, but it's
that's early.
I mean, it's a body horror movie. It's about sort of people's estrangement from their own sexuality and their own body. And when you say, oh, you're projecting, no, that's very much what was on the mind of the people who made it. And one reason it is a haunted house movie. He's dead right. And really, structurally, it's kind of a dull movie. Narratively speaking, it's kind of a dull movie. But what grabs us and what will always grab us is that kind of icky, invasive feeling, like there's something under us. There's something that gets into us, however it does, and is about to erupt out of us.
Another movie on your list. Let's give a listen to The Blair Witch Project.
And this is where we've ended up. And it's all because of me that we're here now. Hungry and cold and hunted.
Now, this was a milestone in movie marketing, too, but was it an effective horror movie, David?
Well, it scared me.
Me
and
too.
I know there's been a huge backlash against it. There are people say, well, there's nothing there. I would argue that the fact that there's sort of nothing there was what was so scary about it. It taught us in an age when directors were just throwing special effects at you, when there were all sorts of manifest, you know, ghosts and monsters and goblins and ghouls, that, you know, what we don't see, a subjective camera held up in the woods, what's outside the frame, a sound, a shadow, a dash of light, there's this irrational terror that was rediscovered in the Blair Witch Project, the thump under the bed or at the end of the hall, and carried forward in Paranormal Activity. You notice in the first one, it's a very limited perspective. You're not going to cut to another angle. You're forced to look at the world through this one single lens, and that's what makes it so terrifying. And it also, you know, hooked up with the, you know, incredible, you know, explosion of technology that allowed us all to have our cameras and all to see the world through our cameras, which paradoxically makes us feel more vulnerable.
Go back to our callers. We've got Evan with us now in La Crosse. Evan, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What's your movie?
To go back to Aliens, my movie is actually John Carpenter's The Thing, his remake of the 50s classic. And I had just seen that for the first time over the summer. I didn't really know much about it. I just knew it's about an alien that can turn itself into like any other living being, like animals or other people. And I thought it was very good, terrifying, and very suspenseful.
Evan, thanks. David, John Carpenter's The Thing.
I love it. And it's on that list of the movies that I mentioned before, as is Blair Witch. It's another body horror movie. The effects were unprecedented, and in fact, in some ways, have never been equaled by this guy named Rob Bottin. You have, you know, things, tentacles exploding out of people, and bodies, you know, sort of literally rearranging themselves in a very gooey and disgusting way before your eyes. And it also, unlike the great Howard Hawks produced original, which is a terrific movie, it's sort of closer to the idea of the original short story, which is you don't know what's inside anybody. You don't really know who anybody is. They could be, you know, all of a sudden they could be really nice, and, you know, you could turn around and they could swat you. You know what, I'm not going to get into Gian Gomeshi anymore. But anyway, it's more of this sort of who is anybody? Who do we know? You know, how do we know these people when we just see their faces or hear their voices? They might have these exploding tentacles.
David, we're just about out of time. You've got two David Lynch movies on your list. I wanted to ask you, though, given that you like David Lynch, excited about the announcement of a return of Twin Peaks?
Hugely, hugely. I mean, look, David Lynch is a major artist. He's made a lot of screwed up movies, but he's one of the few who kind of, you feel, works out of his own unconscious. He puts things on the screen that nobody else does. Many people have said, oh, Blue Velvet and Mulholland Drive, they're not horror movies. Well, of course they're horror movies. They're movies about the unconscious going from people's heads into the real world and changing what we see and identities mutating and monsters springing up from our unconscious. I mean, they are two amazingly great horror films. And if people don't think they're horror films, then they need to expand their definition of horror films.
David, lots of fun. Happy Halloween to you.
Thank you. Happy Halloween.
That's David Edelstein, chief film critic for New York Magazine and NPR's Fresh Air.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. News is coming up next here on Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at Central Time, we'll talk to World War Z author Max Brooks about the state of the horror genre on this Halloween.
First, a scan of the news may suggest that there's plenty to be spooked about these days, even without Halloween dishing its brew of ghosts, goblins, and witches.
Scary viruses, terrorist insurgencies, airplane crashes can put us on alert, but how much of what makes us scared is based in real fear, and how much of it is psychology?
For example, fears about Ebola have reached mass proportions in the U.S., according to a recent Washington Post ABC News poll. Two-thirds of Americans are worried about a widespread Ebola outbreak. Some people say the media and politicians are stoking fear-bola by making alarmist statements about the disease.
With us now is Olga Hazan. She's a staff writer at The Atlantic. She wrote an article in The Atlantic today called The Psychology of Irrational Fears. Olga, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So Ebola, it's a real thing. It's kind of a scary disease. But is our fear, our worry about it, out of proportion here in the U.S.?
Well, it is a scary disease, but, I mean, it doesn't pose quite as big of a threat as, say, the flu does or, you know, any number of other things, car accidents, for example, that are far more likely to hurt us. And so part of this is just that it's a very unfamiliar thing. It's not something we've had here before this year. And things that are unfamiliar or seem kind of foreign tend to be scarier to us than things that are more familiar.
And what is the psychology behind that, that the unfamiliar but remote risk is more powerful than the one we face maybe every day, like a flu or a car crash?
Right. Well, so I think part of it is just like kind of an inability to understand odd ratios, right? So if, let's say, you know that there's a very small chance of getting Ebola, people may focus on, you know, what if I'm that one person who does accidentally sit next to the person on the subway who has Ebola, and then I'll get it too. And that's how they get to be, you know, afraid to leave their house and things like that. And then, you know, just in general, it's something where there's a lot of misinformation out there, and you still have people saying, what if, you know, it gets, you know, to be air transmissible, and what if it changes in some way and becomes more contagious? So that kind of thing can really spread and make us more afraid.
Who do you see as spreading some of that misinformation of overhyping the fear?
Well, there's just been a couple of examples. I mean, I've been kind of in and out watching some of these Ebola hearings, and there's a few lawmakers who have said things that are not quite true. Like Rand Paul said that if someone has Ebola at a cocktail party, they're contagious and you can catch it from them, which of course is only true if they're symptomatic, in which case they probably wouldn't be at a cocktail party. You know, and there's been several kind of calls to close the border because immigrants are bringing Ebola in with them. But of course, people in Mexico don't have Ebola. So, you know, there's just a lot of different statements out there that are a little bit far-fetched.
Well, some people are saying, okay, yes, it's remote risk, but how about better safe than sorry? Let's take this super seriously, err on the side of caution, and so on. What is the problem with that?
I mean, the problem with it is that when we, you know, sometimes when we kind of are overly afraid of something, it actually can increase the risk of something bad happening. So an example of that is like parks tend to get more dangerous when people avoid them out of fear because, you know, the empty park will encourage criminals to kind of move in. So in the case of Ebola, for example, we've had the example of the travel ban or the quarantine, which experts say would only hurt the volunteer efforts in West Africa because you couldn't get personnel and supplies over there as easily.
Now, you mentioned in your piece a phrase I hadn't heard before, instructional fear acquisition. If we hear something should be scary, over time we'll find it scary, whether or not we did initially. Can you talk a little more about that?
Sure. So this is a sort of this theory that, you know, we kind of learn our fears from people around us. So if you are a child and you see your mom, you know, freak out because she sees a lizard, you might start to develop a fear of lizards, even though lizards are not necessarily harmful to you. And actually this could go back as far as, you know, being from when you're a fetus and you kind of, you know, learn kind of from your mom in that way. And then also newborns can learn fear through the odor of their mothers, from the kind of odors that they give off when they're distressed. And so that's like one way that we kind of learn to be afraid of things.
And so looking at the media and this idea of fear acquisition, even if all the media coverage was perfectly responsible and even keeled and so on, is there something about the sheer quantity of it by covering it a lot that might lead to this kind of fear acquisition?
Well, it can sort of, it can sort of spread among people. So as people get more anxious, anxiety tends to kind of spread. So this is what's called mass psychogenic illness, where people kind of avoid things like gluten or vaccines or windmills because other people do. So it can have sort of like a, you know, a wall-to-wall effect where suddenly everyone's worried about Ebola, so you become worried about it too. And the fact that it's here now and the fact that it's in, you know, there's been cases in our hospitals, he was traveling in our subway, that too can kind of, you know, heighten the kind of fear of this and make it kind of feel more scary to people.
You touched a little bit on hypochondria too, and you mentioned it just a bit earlier. Do we see a lot of cases so far of people worried, do I have Ebola, even though they haven't been anywhere near somebody who's had it?
Well, I haven't read specific kind of examples of hypochondria in that way, but there has been some interesting hypochondria in kind of the public sphere. So one example that I found was a school board in North Carolina recently asked their assistant principal to work from home for 21 days after she got back from South Africa on a mission trip. And of course, South Africa is very far from West Africa, where the current outbreak is centered. So it's that kind of thing where, you know, obviously the parents were upset, they pushed back, and they asked them to have, you know, this person work from home so as not to expose the children, even though there was virtually no risk.
You also compare fear of Ebola in the news a lot with, you know, common and recurring fears we hear about shark attacks, even though last year I think you wrote that the U.S. shark fatality total was zero. Did I read that right?
Right. So the statistic I found was that there hasn't been a shark attack death in the U.S. since 2012, but actually 30,000 people at least die in car accidents every year. Which are you, you know, kind of more worried about if you go to the beach and hear that there might be sharks in the area, or, you know, getting in your car and driving? So it's just another one of those examples of how something being unfamiliar or kind of, you know, being associated with a scary idea tends to make it more threatening, even though it's actually not.
Do you think there's value in trying to understand how we get our fears wrong, or at least out of proportion, and be aware of our inability to assess risk, and that might help us assess it better down the road?
Yeah, I mean, I think especially when it comes to public policy discussions, when you're talking about travel bans or mandatory quarantines, you do have a lot of psychology that goes into those, right? I mean, a lot of these hearings and these discussions are driven by fear. And if we try to understand, you know, is this overblown? Are we not recognizing the actual risk? Are we kind of acting more on our emotions than on what would actually happen? You know, it can lead to bad policy outcomes, and that can actually make, you know, the thing that is scary, which is Ebola in West Africa, even scarier.
Olga, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Olga Hazan. She is a staff writer at The Atlantic. She wrote a piece on our irrational fear and how it relates to our reaction to Ebola.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Happy Halloween. We have a special treat for you today. Horror author Max Brooks is with us to talk about the latest edition of his comic series, Extinction Parade, and why we need zombies now more than ever.
Max Brooks is the author of World War Z and the Zombie Survival Guide. He's also the author of the comic series, Extinction Parade. Max, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Good to be here again.
Well, you've got this ongoing series, The Extinction Parade. I understand some people around the country were getting free copies of it in a pre-Halloween celebration. Tell us what Extinction Parade is all about.
Extinction Parade officially is about a zombie outbreak told through the eyes of vampires. And what it really is a study of privilege and what happens when a species is at the top of the food chain and how it's robbed them of the survival skills that the weaker human race has been building over the course of its evolution.
Well, right, and your vampires have been living the good life for thousands of years. They're aristocrats. They're kind of soft. Are they ready for this?
They are not ready for this. Initially, they actually like the zombie outbreak because they like the chaos. And then they realize slowly and carefully that they have an inconvenient truth, which is, what are they going to eat when all the humans are gone?
You know, this sounds like a series where humans exist mainly as a contested food source. Do we have human heroes, or are they kind of on the sidelines here?
Yeah, they are definitely on the sidelines. The humans are trapped in between the growing zombie plague and these apex predator vampires.
Now, why did you choose to tell this story as a graphic novel?
You know, it's a visual story, and I always wanted it to be told in comic book format. I think it's also more important for younger viewers or younger readers, because I think that's... I think it's important for every generation coming up to understand the power of struggle and how failure actually makes you stronger and better, as opposed to just living the good life. I think when things are handed to you, you're completely unprepared for adversity.
And when you were on to talk about World War Z a while back, you talked about, in part, yeah, it's a zombie story, but it's also a story about human infrastructure and planning and choices we make. Do you hope, and you just kind of mentioned our reaction to adversity, do you hope that we'll take this and maybe rethink the way we live our lives, teach our kids?
You know, I hope so. As a parent, I'm watching a whole generation of young people growing up where both soccer teams are given trophies, and parents actually go to job interviews now with their kids. And I thought, how is that helping them when they're not being allowed to fail and pick themselves back up? I grew up seeing what happens to the kids who had it easy, and they do not make for good adults.
Do you think there are other real-world applications here? I'm thinking about a story I read that last year General Martin Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, read your book World War Z and took it to the rest of the Chiefs of Staff and said, we need to be prepared for a zombie attack. I mean, do you think there are real-world applications here, even though we're messing around in the world of fantasy and horror?
Oh, no, definitely, because I think that even if the catalyst, the enemy, is fictional, which is zombies, the preparation is very real. You know, people ask me if I have a zombie preparedness kit, and I say, yeah, it's just my earthquake kit. It's all the same stuff. You know, with Zombie Survival Guide and World War Z, I sort of talk about physical preparedness. And with Extinction Parade, I talk about emotional and psychological preparedness, sort of what do you need in your heart and your soul to be ready when things fall apart.
Well, now, if we are living a reasonably good life and not running into adversity, and we can't go out and find a zombie attack, how can we train ourselves in adversity to be ready for bigger adversity?
Well, I think taking risks, and I think embracing failure instead of running away from it, and I think seeing every failure as a chance to get smarter and stronger and more resilient, because the truth is, it's not about how awesome you are, it's how resilient you are.
Do the humans get a chance to be resilient, or are they just sort of the pawns, at least in your new series?
Well, humans actually are resilient. That's the point of the story, is that initially vampires sort of look down on them as the biological peasants, as the weaker species, and then they slowly come to realize that it's their weaknesses that have made them strong. It's the compensating for those weaknesses that have made them more resilient, and that the humans have an emotional, psychological survival kit that the vampires just never had.
Is there an environmental stewardship angle here? The vampires realizing that they may have reached peak human and have to start taking action?
No, definitely. And I think that's an important point, because initially the zombies ignore the vampires. And that's important because that's the danger of ecological disaster. You know, nobody's going to directly die from climate change, but they're going to die from all the secondary and tertiary problems caused by climate change. And that's the problem with the vampires. Initially, they ignore the threat until, like I said, they have their inconvenient truth and realize, oh, it's not that the zombies directly threaten us, but they threaten our food source.
I want to see the vampire Al Gore's PowerPoint presentation now.
Oh, there's a whole issue of that where we literally have our vampire Al Gore,
nice.
who stops the vampires in the middle of a blood orgy to explain to them that we're all going to die unless we get our act together.
So humans, vampires, you know, zombies, it seems like there's a lot of overlap here. I mean, do you think in a way, I don't know, in a sort of a lit major way, they're all the same person, they're all the same thing?
Well, you know, I think they can be sort of whatever you want them to be. You know, with me growing up watching vampires sort of be worshipped as these sleek and sexy super beings, I took away something very different from the exact same stories, which was they don't have a job.
Well, I'm turning to more kind of World War Z real world crossovers. You wrote earlier this month that you've been asked to compare Ebola to your work in World War Z. You said, when it comes to the world's response to Ebola, you're encouraged. You're seeing a lot more positives as compared to how you portrayed things in World War Z. How so?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think Ebola, the response to Ebola is getting a lot of negative press because that sensationalism and that sells. But the truth is, in my lifetime, I've rarely seen world governments come together so swiftly and massively as in the case of Ebola. I mean, the fact that the U.S. Army is sending 4,000 troops to Africa, the fact that the U.N. is starting to analyze the economic impact of Ebola, all these new measures are being put into place. I mean, this is something I certainly have not seen in a long time.
There are, you know, Ebola is one thing, but there's a lot of scary stuff happening in the real world right now. There are the journalist beheadings, there are our wars, you know, Ebola itself. Do we need this genre right now more than ever, or do you think, on the other hand, maybe there's enough horror already?
Well, I think we do need the genre more than ever because it allows us one step back from the truth, in that real horror triggers our psychological defense mechanism. I think it's human nature that when a threat is too real, such as Ebola or ISIS, people tune out. They don't want to hear it. It's too scary. But if you present these facts with the veneer of science fiction or horror, then it allows people to still sleep at night and hopefully digest some of the lessons from the real world.
As we mark Halloween, what are your favorite horror books and movies? What do you look to maybe to watch again and again on this holiday?
I don't think I can ever get enough of George Romero's original Dawn of the Dead. I think it's an amazing parable for his entire generation of baby boomers. It really tracks their sort of descent into mindless consumerism. And I've always said that I think it should be sold in a box set with Easy Rider. It should be called The Baby Boomers, The Beginning and the End.
So is that something you think is true of your work, too? Are you in that tradition where the zombies are sort of a mark of heedless consumerism?
I don't know about consumerism. I try to put real-world social commentary into my work. I don't want it just to be slasher hacker. I'm always trying to say something more, something deeper. I'm trying not to be too preachy, but I would like to follow in his footsteps. So whether I do a good job or not, that's up for the world to decide.
Is there room for the slasher hacker realm with maybe no hidden meanings behind it?
Well, there's no room in my world. Hmm. I have no patience for mindless entertainment or torture porn. I like a little bit of, I guess, intellectual nutrition in my action. I mean, and it doesn't have to be heavy-handed. You know, Jaws, I thought, was a great example of capitalism run amok. But at the end of the day, it was still a giant shark eating people.
Well, for a long time, it was vampires sitting on the throne in the horror world. Zombies kind of ousted them. They're the big popular monster right now. Why do you think that is? If we take your idea that You sort of, we get the monster of our time. We're into the one that speaks to us. What is it about zombies that speak to us right now?
I think the apocalyptic nature of zombie stories, I think they allow us to sort of explore the apocalypse without it becoming too real. I think when people see a movie like Contagion or read a book like The Road by Cormac McCarthy, I think it's too real. I think people shut them out. But if you see a good zombie story, you're still seeing exactly what would happen in a Hurricane Katrina, but you are able to see it because it's zombies.
Now, you've got Extinction Parade ongoing. You had the Harlem Hellfighters come out, I think, earlier this year. What's next? What's your next project in the works?
There's a couple projects. The Harlem Hellfighters, the true story of the 369th African-American unit in World War I, the movie rights for that has been optioned by Will Smith's company, and I'm currently writing the screenplay. So that was literally 16 years in production. So hopefully it'll see the big screen sometime in the future.
Max, what are you going to be for Halloween?
I am going to be the father of Charlie Chaplin.
Okay. Sounds good. Well, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Good to talk to you.
That was Max Brooks, author of World War Z and the Zombie Survival Guide. He's also the author of the comic series Extinction Parade and the graphic novel The Harlem Hellfighters. By the way, right now at the Central Time Facebook page, we are looking to find out your favorite horror movies of all time. Head over there, share your thoughts. Great scary movies, past or present. Maybe something you're going to watch today or this weekend.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.